This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Connecticut Labor Department has seen a huge spike in workers filing unemployment claims. NBC 30 reported that in the last week, 52,000 claims have been filed. Before the coronavirus pandemic, an average week saw up to 3,000 claims. But unemployment insurance doesn't cover freelancers, those who are self-employed or gig economy workers. Today, Where We Live, we focus on the impact of the coronavirus on them. Are you self-employed? Are you a freelancer who's worried about finding work because of coronavirus? You can join our conversation, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Coming up, we talk to Connecticut residents who drive for ride-sharing companies like Lyft and Uber. First, joining me now by phone is Krista Dupre. She's a hairstylist at Bowl & Brush in Rocky Hill, Connecticut, also a hairdressing educator. Krista, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you so much for having me.
I mentioned that you're a hairstylist, so how long have you worked at Bowl & Brush in Rocky Hill?
The salon opened about just in November, so I've been there since it's opened, but I've been doing hair for about 13 years.
And tell me, when we think about when we go to a salon and we have our hairstylist that we like to go to, how does that work? Are you essentially self-employed and you're renting a chair?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have a salon owner, but essentially, you know, we joke around, we just call her our landlord because, you know, we all do work together, but we rent our chair individually. So I am just a self-employed 1099 worker.
When you said you've been doing hair styling for, I think, 13 years, if that's right. Did I hear you correctly?
Correct.
Yeah. And what has that been like for you, having, again, to be essentially self-employed and find salons they have space for you to do your business?
Well, it's definitely been a journey of, you know, finding the right spot. I was on my own for a little bit in a salon studio. I really loved the place that I'm at now. And it's definitely been a journey of hopping to some different places. But about 4 years ago is when I chose to go self-employed and essentially be my own boss.
Tell us what your business has looked like in the last couple of weeks. When did you really start to see things changing, Krista?
Right. So I think it was right about almost 2 weeks ago. So obviously, you know, the news was on. We were listening about, you know, cases popping up in Connecticut, and something that seemed so far away very quickly became very real. I think really it hit everybody once the school started to close. So my son goes to school in Wethersfield at one of the magnet schools, and they closed. And after that, you know, my schedule had to drastically change because I had to care for him. And once the schools started to close, the cancellations started to come in. So my clients started to cancel. At that time, most stylists have waived any cancellation policy fees or anything like that. So that was really when it started to affect my business, was when, you know, people started to cancel. Slowly after that, you know, the recommendations were coming in from the state to practice social distancing and staying 6 feet away from people. And really, once that started to happen, that's when it started to make me feel uncomfortable working behind the chair. I mean, we are so close to people, we're touching them. And that was definitely, you know, some concern of me. I have a mom who works in a nursing home. So I wanted to make sure that I kept my family safe and me safe. So I actually decided to stop working last week, before the governor had declared that salons would be closing.
That's right. So just on Thursday, yesterday, Governor Ned Lamont issued another executive order ordering nail salons, barber shops, and hair salons to close. So before we even got to this point where Governor Lamont issued this executive order, tell us what's going through your mind, because you're hearing, again, you want to keep yourself safe, you want to keep your clients safe, but at the same time, you have to pay the bills.
Absolutely. And you know what? Being on social media, the hairdressing community is so connected, and I think everyone was struggling with that, you know, and I really feel and understand your point of view on either side, but I know this is the livelihood of people. This is how they make hairdressers make their living, is if they don't see clients, they don't make a paycheck. So for me, it was definitely that sense of how am I going to pay my bills? Because regardless of if I have clients coming in, my rent is still due. So not only am I out of work right now, but I'm not making any money coming in, but I still have to pay for my space that I rent. It was definitely a tough decision, but I think at the end of the day, it was what I felt right doing for my family, and that was the decision that I made. But I know for some people, they worked up until the end. So, and I can understand that as well, because, you know, there's that fear of the unknown. How am I going to pay my bills? And that's understandable as well.
You're listening to Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. My guest by phone, Krista Dupre, a hairstylist at Bowl & Brush in Rocky Hill, also a hairdressing educator. We're talking with Krista and others who don't have the luxury of working remotely. Their jobs are very much customer-centered and in-person. And now that hair salons and other establishments have had to close because of coronavirus, we wanted to hear from Connecticut residents about what their plans are now, as many people are left in the lurch. You can join our conversation 1-888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I mentioned unemployment claims are going up across the state, Krista, but the people that are eligible have worked for employers that pay into the unemployment insurance program. So because you're self-employed, is this not open to you?
Correct. As to my understanding, it is not currently open to us, regardless of if we have been forced to shut or if we chose to. So at this point, my only kind of aid at this time would be a small business loan. So that's something that is, you know, really something that I might have to look into in the coming months.
We're getting a word, this was just earlier this week, the Department of Economic and Community Development, also known as DECD, there have been announcements that they're trying to help this agency, helping small businesses and nonprofit organizations in Connecticut that have been impacted by COVID-19. They're trying to see if people can be eligible for disaster relief loans of up to $2 million from the federal SBA. So is this something that you might look into? Is that what you're saying, Krista?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that if anything, you know, the bills, if they don't suspend the mortgage payments, which could potentially trickle down to my landlord, quote unquote, and possibly me, then that is something that I'll have to look into just in order to maintain, you know, some sort of stability during this time.
Again, Krista Dupre joining us here on Where We Live. We wanted to get another perspective, so joining us now also by phone is Sarah Coffold. Sarah, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
You were on our show late last year as the artistic director of the Voices of Kinsinity Choir and Consonare Choral Community in Eastern Connecticut. You help facilitate a women's chorus, also a children's chorus. This is especially a hard time for people who are performers, artists, who they can no longer perform in front of an audience, and you have to keep the people around you safe as well. As a choir member, this must be particularly difficult for you.
Absolutely. I think a lot of choir members are feeling a little bit of grief and mourning over losing that aspect that is a big part of their lives. It's singing with other people and having that community. And now that's gone. And there's no way to really recreate that online. And I know that some fabulous choir directors right now are exploring ideas of doing Zoom sort of rehearsals or ways to connect over Zoom, but it's really only one way. You can't all sing together virtually in real time. We can do a recording after and then create a virtual choir, which has been successful with some composers like Eric Whitaker. But we're still missing that connection piece. And that's really hard for a lot of the singers in our community groups. But I'm most worried about the singers in our professional groups who
are
not getting paid.
They're freelancers, so you guys are mentioning this is hitting their finances.
Absolutely. Because we had concerts planned for April and May that aren't going to happen. So we won't receive the revenue from those concerts. And since we're a small nonprofit or arts organization, we don't have a lot of money to pay them, even though they're not going to perform. So it becomes this very difficult balance. And how do we keep our singers from not getting food or not getting paid while also making sure that our arts organization doesn't collapse in this time? It's very uncertain because we rely on money from the public in order for us to run. So people that are willing to donate and give money at our concerts as a way to help keep music alive in our community, which is our whole mission, is to build community through singing together and choral music. And that feels very scary right now because we can't do that as easily.
Did you have concerts planned recently, and how did the venues handle, you having to cancel? Have you been hearing from groups that can help your professional singers?
Yes. Thankfully, there have been a lot of freelance artist resources that have been going out online, including one called Artist Relief Tree through Facebook, and they've raised a considerable amount of money in a few short days that artists can apply to receive funds. There's also a lot of COVID-19 freelance artist resources pages that have lots of different links that artists can reach out to. So that's good. We've been very fortunate in the venues that we had signed up with were churches for our next concerts. We were supposed to have a concert next weekend with a festival, but luckily it was a church and they didn't charge us to use their space. So we're very lucky in that respect. But I know that other arts organizations are not quite so lucky and have already paid fees up front to use particular venues.
You're listening to Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. My guests on the phone, Krista Dupre, a hairstylist in Rocky Hill, and Sarah Coffold, an artistic director of the Consonare Choral Community in Eastern Connecticut. Today we're focusing on Connecticut residents who are freelancers or self-employed and how this pandemic is affecting their livelihoods. You can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I wanted to take a couple of quick calls before we head to break. Deborah's calling from Colchester. Deborah, tell us briefly what you're experiencing.
Hi. Yes, I'm a hairdresser, and I have been working out of my home. It's legal for hairdressers to work out of their homes, and that way you can control one person at a time. I wash my cape in between clients. I wear a mask, a N95 mask, so that we're not exchanging aerosols, And hairdressers are allowed to this Barbasol in the supply house. It's hospital-grade disinfectant, so I spray down all surfaces, and my clients are feeling safe, and I am too, so that's how we're doing that.
Deborah,
that
thank
you. That's a thought for other hairdressers to go to people's houses or go have them come to theirs.
Are you worried at all, Deborah, when we hear from public health officials that with social distancing, really to keep a distance from others, are you worried even taking those precautions that you might be putting yourself at risk or entering a home where someone's sick?
No, not really, because I spray down everything in the area we're going to work, and I do wear the mask before I come in. I put it on before entering or before they enter my house, and if they're obviously sick coughing, no, I won't do them. But because there's no symptoms and you don't know, I wear the mask. It protects them from me and me from them. So no, I'm not worried about that. I don't do a lot of clients. It's not, so they are spaced out like two people or a person every other day or so. So yeah. I have time to clean. And so that's working out.
Yeah. Well, Deborah,
I can see where a salon would be terrible.
Yeah. Well, Deborah, we thank you for calling in, and we hope that you remain safe and healthy. I wanted to take another call, Allison from West Hartford. Allison, tell us briefly your experience.
Hi. So I am a headhunter and a recruiter, and I'm a 1099 employee, and my company, we focus on recruiting totally in the food and beverage space. So all of our clients are hotels and restaurants, both big and small. You know, we have clients local in Connecticut and then obviously across the country. So, you know, my income is solely dependent on the success of their hires. And right now, kind of the industry's been put at a complete halt. So as is my income at this moment.
And so what are you going to do, Allison, as we hear that, again, with social distancing, this isn't going away anytime soon? How are you going to make do?
Well, I mean, I guess what I can do personally is, you know, be a supportive consult to all the restaurants that we deal with on a daily basis and kind of help them through the crisis. You know, I think that... you know, me personally, I think I just have to sit tight and kind of ride out the storm like everyone else. But I do think that long term, this will affect how people hire in the food and beverage space, who will be able to survive this, you know, whether it's big or small, and what kind of assistance the restaurants and hotels and the hospitality industry will receive from the government, both here at the state level and the federal level, will be really help dictate, you know, my success and I think the success of everyone in the industry long term. So,
well, Allison, thank you for your call, and we wish you luck in the weeks ahead.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I want to thank Krista Dupre, a hairstylist in Rocky Hill, and Sarah Coffold, an artistic director, again, of the Consonare Choral Community in Eastern Connecticut, for calling in to share their perspective. Krista and Sarah, we hope to follow up with you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Lucy.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about gig economy workers, people who drive for Lyft and Uber, with, again, coronavirus spreading across our country. How are they going to make a living? You can join us, too, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Are you a gig worker now affected by the shutdowns and social distancing that's become the norm due to coronavirus? We want to hear from you today, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We reached out to local Uber and Lyft drivers here in Connecticut. We asked them how the pandemic has affected them. A Ginger writes on Facebook, "It covers a quarter of my income. I need this money, but those cars are moving incubators for the virus." Mark on Facebook writes, "Uber is a second job for me as well. I don't eat if I don't Uber." And Marnie writes, "This is my side hustle. My regular paycheck barely covers the bills. I need this to exist and pay things like medical copays and just getting by every week. Not being able to count on this income is financially devastating." Joining us now via Zoom is Molly Tran, director of the public health program at Elmhurst College. Her research focuses on the occupational health of gig economy workers. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about gig work, I had mentioned Uber and Lyft drivers, but if maybe you could define it better for us and what exactly that means.
Definitely. So the term is used in a lot of different ways, sometimes, you know, even to include, you know, things like freelancers. When I use it, I mean basically work that's transacted over these apps. And so that's different from traditional freelancers, because the workers really have to accept the terms of the app in order to access the work. And so, you know, they don't get to set the terms of their employment. They don't get to set the rates or, you know, what work is paid and what's unpaid and inside the scope of the work. And so that has a lot of, you know, implications for their ability to keep working and to have a, you know, a cushion or a nest egg in ways that maybe traditional freelancers might have a little bit more of. Mm.
So these gig workers, they don't have health insurance, or they're not eligible for workman's comp or unemployment insurance?
That's right, yeah. So they're considered independent contractors. So usually these apps consider themselves just tech companies, and then the people who work for them are independent contractors. So they don't have access to a lot of the same worker protections as people who are traditionally employed, things like health insurance, workers' compensation insurance, unemployment, really none of those protections.
Gig economy workers have really grown in the last several years. Do we have any idea, percentage-wise, how many they are in our economy?
Yeah, it's a really hard question that researchers are working on because it's such a diverse group. So, you know, there are many people who are, as we heard, working, a gig work job, maybe on the side of a traditional job, other people who are maybe doing multiple gigs. There was a Pew Foundation study back in 2016 that found that 8% of Americans had earned money doing gig work, but that included things like online task work, as well as delivery of services like driving and grocery delivery.
There's something appealing for people who've chosen this work because they have the flexibility. As one of these people that I had read the comment from social media, this is their side hustle. But now it's really problematic because this is the type of job, especially if you're doing ride sharing, where you can't have people in close proximity to you because of this illness sweeping our country. And now if they can't work this job, and maybe they have another job that, because of the economy, that's always slowing, it really puts them in a precarious position, Molly.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think these workers are always in a pretty precarious position, just because, you know, the apps can change the terms they're always sort of at the mercy of that. But right now, especially, we see, with them not having access to health insurance, and some of the apps now are, you know, potentially offering some sick leave or some benefits if the workers test positive for coronavirus. But of course, we know that's difficult for anyone to get a test right now. And then particularly since these workers don't have access to things like health insurance unless they have it through some other job. So that's especially risky.
You can join our conversation, especially if you are one of these gig economy workers that we're talking about. Maybe you drive Uber or Lyft, or there's another position that you have that's really, it's hard to hold on to that job because of coronavirus. The number 888-720-9677, that's 888-720-WMPR, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You mentioned that gig workers make up about 8% of the U.S. economy.
Yes, that's the last figure that we have.
That's a big number. And in terms of demographics, what do we know about the people, again, that are taking these jobs?
Yeah, so again, it's a really diverse group. So you have, kind of splits by the people who are doing it really more as a side hustle for nice to have income, and the people who are really financially dependent on it. The last figures we have on that is, for the driving services like Uber, about 7% of the drivers drive about 50 hours a week or more. So they're a minority of the people doing the majority of work. And those people who are really financially dependent on it tend to be, non-white. They tend to be lower income, lower socioeconomic status, lower levels of education. So they're already a sort of marginalized, more at-risk group. They're really dependent on this income that now they can't have.
Stephen's calling from Colchester. Stephen, what's your situation?
I'm an Uber driver.
And how long have you been an Uber driver?
I've been driving for just over 2 years.
And tell us, over the last couple of weeks, what has changed for you in terms of this coronavirus, these cases are growing?
The last 2 weeks, I haven't been driving at all. I don't feel safe out there. A lot of the businesses shut down. I mean, the casinos are shut down. I drive out in that area. All the colleges are gone. The college kids are gone. So there's no money coming in from that area. It's tough. Like, mm-hmm. I refuse to go out there. I don't need to catch anything.
Mm-hmm. Was this something that you were doing primarily or as a side job?
It's actually primarily because I'm retired and I'm on disability right now, and I just use that for extra money to make ends meet. And right now the money's just not coming in at all.
And so what are you going to do, Stephen? What are your other options?
My only other option is, I mean, I get my disability check, but other than that, it's take a chance and go out there and drive. My wife is a school bus driver, and she also drives for Uber and Lyft, and she's laid off from driving school buses.
When we hear about programs or initiatives from the governor's office or the Department of Economic and Community Development, what do you want to see state lawmakers, policymakers doing to help you and your wife?
I have no idea on that.
So right now you're just going to make do and see what the next few weeks brings.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, that's all I can do is just, I mean, my wife wants to go out and drive. She's been driving actually the last 2 weeks. I don't feel her going out there is safe either, because you just don't know like who you're picking up and things like that. So right now we're just hunkering down in the house and waiting this out and see what happens.
Well, Stephen, thank you for calling in to Where We Live, and you can join us as well, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Let's try Michael in Groton. Michael, you're on the show.
Hello, thank you.
So tell us, what's your perspective?
Yes, so I hear a lot of the, you know, kind of gloom and doom, and obviously we're in a very, very tough spot for a lot of people. But one thing I found with the gig economy, I'm an Uber driver as a secondary income, and what I've found is that there's a lot of flexibility and freedom that you don't have in a W-2 job. In fact, that's why I do it. You know, my main income's a business that I run. And so having something I can work anytime, and if they change the agreement on me, I can just switch. If Uber changes something on me, I'm not an Uber driver anymore, I'm a Lyft driver. And if they change it, I find something else. And Uber and Uber Eats are the same app. So for someone who's not comfortable driving passengers, they could still be a delivery driver, which there's a high demand for. And I think also for a lot of people, there's opportunities they might not be seeing because there's so much gloom and doom and the market's crashing and everything's falling apart. For example, a business owner friend of mine recently reached out and asked me to run their social media because they never really had a social media presence before. And now they, of course, really need one. There's not much walk-in traffic to their business. And I think there's not enough focus on some of the potential bright sides for people who, you know, who might be able to work from home in ways they didn't realize, or new opportunities, or, you know, I'm thinking about Kroger, how they're hiring 10,000 people and working directly with restaurants to hire their laid off waiters and wait staff.
Well, Michael, we appreciate that point, and it is good to hear some positives again with the last couple of weeks and many people's lives. I wanted to go back to my guest via Zoom, Molly Tran, director of the public health program at Elmhurst College. Molly, how do you respond to what Michael's saying?
Yeah, so I think that's in the research that we've done with Uber and Lyft drivers. That's the reason that they do it. And it is fulfilling a need for people to, you know, have this income that they can do around a caregiving schedule or because they're starting a business. And that's the real upside to it. The downside that we've seen, and of course is becoming really much more apparent now, is that lack of a safety net and the fact that they don't have access to insurance. And the fact that, you know, again, something we're seeing in more relief now is what your first caller was talking about, which is constantly making that trade-off between their own safety and health and making income. So in times where there's not a pandemic, we're seeing it more with things like driving late hours or maybe going to a neighborhood that they don't feel safe in. Now it's becoming, do I drive and, you know, potentially expose myself to the virus versus taking advantage of the opportunity to continue making income.
Earlier, Molly, you mentioned that, I know this has been reported also by the New York Times, companies like Uber and Lyft, Instacart, they've said they're going to pay workers 14 days if they have a diagnosis of coronavirus. We know it is difficult to even get tested for coronavirus. You have to have specific symptoms and criteria before you can even get a test. But I'm wondering, with the way these companies have treated these Uber and Lyft contractors, so to speak, in previous years, if they are maybe driving for them, but they've also got another job, would they still be able to be eligible for this 14 days of pay? What do we know about what Uber and Lyft has promised?
I don't know the details of what they've promised to the drivers, aside from what you mentioned and what's been reported in the press. I do think, you know, they're right to be skeptical of this promise. And, you know, between the fact that they may not be able to get a test. Also, you know, I don't know how they're defining 2 weeks worth of pay. Is that really 2 weeks of working every day? Are they saying maybe, you know, the average driver drives 3 days in 2 weeks, and so that's what we're going to give you? There's always a little bit of reason to be skeptical about how these companies, based on the past history, how these companies are going to treat the drivers. Mm.
And I understand some of them are actually even renting their cars. We got a comment from Jonathan who writes, I'm afraid they will repossess my car because I can't afford to pay the car note or any of my bills. Currently, I'm short $941 for the month. I can't even put gas in my car when I try to drive. I maybe acquired $20 in 5 hours. He writes, we need payment freezes on rent and all bills by the government until further notice if we're going to survive this, not just as Uber drivers, but all citizens need this. It's a sad and terrifying time. I'm not sure how I'm going to recover from any of this. Molly, again, the perspective as you are studying gig workers and what this means for so many.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you hear things like that and it's terrible to hear. And there are many workers who are renting their cars from the companies, and I haven't heard anything about them, you know, potentially freezing, you know, the payments on that. Again, even from the studies that we've done of the drivers at times that are more normal than this, they have a lot of financial stress about, you know, making those payments, you know, making enough and, you know, not having an issue with the app where they don't get paid what they should, things like that. I mean, I can imagine this time where the business is just not there, that, you know, the stress levels and the work-related stress levels are much higher.
Well, I want to thank Molly Tran for joining us via Zoom here on Where We Live. She's director of the public health program at Elmhurst College. Her research focuses on the occupational health of gig workers. Molly, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. After the break, we're going to hear from an economist about what all this means and what we can expect coming up in the next weeks and months. Tara, another Uber driver, writes, ever since the virus hit Connecticut, Ubering and Lyft has been very slow for me, even some of my fellow drivers. This is my main income. I rely on driving, so it's hit me hard. I also do Grubhub, and even that lately has been slow, surprisingly. You can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been focusing on how the pandemic is affecting workers who don't qualify for unemployment insurance. Joining us now is an economist via Zoom, Ibrahim Shekaki, assistant professor of economics at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. You can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Ibrahim, as an economist, your reaction to hearing several Connecticut residents calling in and sharing their comments on social media. Again, they're gig economy workers, freelancers. They're really concerned about where we are today.
Yeah. Lucy, I mean, I'm not surprised. That's what I would say. I was listening to Krista and some of the Uber drivers that were talking to you. And, you know, if we look at the last 10 years in terms of what we call macroeconomic performance, it might seem that, you know, things were going okay. We were in a state of recovery, which basically means that, you know, yes, output was increasing steadily, unemployment levels were low, but it was hiding under the surface two issues that people who have been working on economic and income inequality have been talking about for a long time. The first is that we have the distribution of income and wealth has reached a level of inequality that has never been witnessed before. But perhaps more importantly, second, is that many of the new jobs that were being created do not provide workers with a real safety net, in the sense that first, they don't provide job security, of a person actually believing that they're going to have their job on the long run or the medium run, and also that they pay low wages. And this low wage is very relevant today. A report actually came out last November addressing the extent of low-paying jobs. And basically, it showed that around 53 million workers had a median income of $18,000 annually. Now, why is this important today? Well, it's because it basically shows that very few people save in this country. 20% of Americans do not save at all. And surveys are showing that 60% of Americans have less than $1,000 in their saving account. That means that they don't have any safety net. And a few weeks can mean exactly what I heard the people on your show say, that they won't be able to pay their rent, their mortgage, their utility bills, let alone the new costs, you know, stocking up, formula, sanitization, you know, all of these issues.
And we know the end of the month is getting close, and this is really going to hit people hard as their bills come due. We're hearing that Bank of America, I believe New York State's working to have it to freeze mortgage payments, so that way, you know, you're not going to be in default. But I'm just wondering if we can talk more about some of the federal policies and measures that we've been hearing from the administration, the Federal Reserve. What kind of impact will that have? Let's start first with the lowering of interest rates.
Yeah, so I mean, normally in recessions, and I think this is what happened in the beginning, normally the first go-to tools are what we call monetary policy. So these are policies that are controlled by the central bank, so the Federal Reserve in the US. And those have two options. You either decrease the interest rate, and so the idea is to encourage investment. Now, the problem with that is, A, we were already operating at a very low level of interest rate, so below 2%. So there wasn't really a big margin over there. And perhaps secondly, more importantly, the problem really wasn't only an issue of companies and their finances. The other tool, the other monetary policy, is to increase what we call liquidity. Mm-hmm. So ensuring that banks and financial intermediaries have the liquidity to provide for businesses and small businesses. And that's when the Fed also injected something like $1.5 trillion just last week to deal with this liquidity issues. The problem is that these monetary tools, whether it's the interest rate or, you know, putting money supply in the economy, is not going to work with this crisis. And I think this is why a lot of people are talking about this being a much larger crisis going forward, depending on how long this lasts from a public health issue. And so kind of the response was that, okay, we need to deal with other types of policy, what we call fiscal policy. And that's exactly where the government plays a larger role. And that is basically going to be focusing on supporting what we call aggregate demand, consumption. If you look at the economy of the U.S., the whole output of the U.S., 70% of that comes from consumer household consumption. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about around, you know, $14 trillion. That is, a lot of it is going to disappear in the next coming weeks. Mm-hmm. People are not going out. They're not going to sporting events. They're not paying at restaurants. They're not going on tourism. They're not traveling. And so this is something that they're trying to focus on. And I think the, well, unprecedented in one sense policy is to actually send Americans money. And I think this is what governments are now realizing. That's what we need to focus. And we need to focus on doing this now, because we have such a large number of Americans who basically live paycheck to paycheck.
So what you're talking about, the real economy versus the focus on the stock markets, people having consumer confidence to continue to spend money.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, that's what we always have to keep in mind. The stock market can rebound much easily, more than when we're talking about the real economy. So the focus, I believe, now should be on this issue of supporting workers. This should be the goal. It's very important to understand that public health is much more important than public debt. And so we need to think about supporting workers, both as households. This labor force, you know, is part of a household, and you need to talk about their basic necessities, but also as workers, providing them with protection. And, you know, this is something that a lot of countries are already starting to do. I mean, even in the U.S., I know, for example, in New York, there's this 90-day mortgage payment mm-hmm. freeze. But a lot of countries have done a lot of other policies as well. And I think that's what we should focus on. We should focus on the quality and the duration of these benefits, you know, including suspending utility bills. I heard one of the people on the show talking about paying their bills and their rent. So freezing rent and mortgage, payments, utility bills, talking about installments for bank loans for small and medium-sized companies. But basically, you know, trying to make sure that people, at least on the short run, have what, you know, they need for their survival, basically.
You're hearing via Zoom Ibrahim Shekaki, Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity College in Hartford. I want to take a couple more calls in just another minute, Ibrahim. But when we hear about the president, also senators in our Democratic senators even talked about sending cash payments to all Americans, how much of an impact will that make?
Well, a big impact for sure, but only for a short period of time. That's what I'm trying to focus here. So, you know, there is this discussion about legislation of $1 trillion. Half of that would go to, you know, partly bailing out some big, probably airlines, but also partly, you know, going to medium-sized businesses to make sure that they can keep people on their payrolls. The other half is basically checks of, you know, the number hasn't been decided yet, $1,200, $1,000 per month. And so, yes, on the short run, this is useful because it makes sure that people have money to pay for what they need in terms of, you know, food, survival. But then we should extend this and we should make sure that other policies are also set until we know, because that's the thing. You have this fundamental uncertainty about what's going to be going on. And unfortunately, our labor force is being treated as this, you know, reserve pool of workers where you take them when you need them. And then when something goes wrong, they're fired.
I'm glad you bring up that point, because that's what's happening to a lot of people, because establishments are closing down. Municipal governments are trying to figure out who they can let go because they can't work remotely, worried about the bottom line. But you have other countries, I think, is it France, where coronavirus, people are not going to get fired because they can't work.
Absolutely. So again, those were some in Italy, you also have a number of policies, new funds to hire new doctors and nurses, tax credits, support for family with children, paying self-employed. We're talking about the gig economy. In Italy, they have 600 euros for any self-employed person. So they are realizing that, you know, this is a public health issue. Yes, this is an economic issue. Right now, this is about human beings and their livelihoods and them being able also to survive what's going to come the next few weeks, few months. We're not really sure.
You can join our conversation 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Darcy's calling from Glastonbury. Darcy, what are you experiencing now?
Well, just in my industry, I'm a children's entertainer. We do family entertainment. So our industry is completely dead in the water. And I kind of have two aspects. There's like the things that we can't do anything about. And then there's the part there. We're creative people. And there are things that we can do if we work together. So, for instance, I've lost all my fairs and festivals. I'm not going to be face painting or doing henna at anything in the foreseeable future. We don't have project graduations anymore. We're not just losing the little tiny birthday parties. We're losing large corporate events. And we are gig workers. We work as subcontractors, as entertainers, et cetera. But again, because we're creative people, it's sort of, we can think outside the box. So one of the things that I'm doing is we've got all these kids that are home from school and parents that are forced to work from home and keep their kids busy while they're trying to focus on what they can do. So we're making make and take arts and crafts boxes and having designated pickup times at my art studio in East Hartford, or we're delivering in our local area, and we're hoping to expand that. We're keeping other people working, helping with deliveries. I just made a deal with a balloon decor and twisting, an entertainment company in Milford, where over the weekends there'll be pickup points at her location, just to kind of spread this out.
Well, thank you, Darcy. We're glad to hear that you are being creative and finding other ways to help yourself and other people in your industry. One more quick call, Michael from Cromwell. We just have a couple of minutes, Michael. What are you doing?
Hi, Lucy. So, in any case, I'm a church musician in Cromwell and a piano teacher with churches all kind of masses on the hold for now. I'm not sure how that's all going to shake out, but for piano lessons, I continue my lessons over FaceTime with my students, and it's working out really well. I mean, I can keep a paycheck coming in that way, so to speak. But it also brings a sense of normalcy to them and to me as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad to hear that, Michael. Thank you for giving us a call. Ibrahim, we're almost out of time. As a macroeconomist, what are you going to be watching for in the next few weeks?
Well, you know, there are already, unfortunately, bleak numbers coming out. Like you said, unemployment filing has increased 33% in just 1 week. But there are numbers talking about, at least from quarter to quarter, from the first to second quarter of the year, something like a 10% decrease in GDP. That is huge. You also are talking about around 3.5 million people losing their jobs between the first and the second quarter. So I'm waiting for, actually, in terms of numbers, I'm waiting for April 3rd and April 29th when we have figures on unemployment and GDP. But more importantly, I am waiting to see the government extend whatever it's talking about, that those $1,000 or something close to that sent to people, but focusing again on the workers in this economy. They are the vast majority of people in the labor force. And you have to focus on providing for them. You have to make sure that not only are we sending them money, but we're also enacting legislation regarding freezing rents, freezing utility bills, making sure that people have what they need for this relatively shorter period, and then we can think about the long run.
Well, I want to thank Ibrahim Shekaki again for joining us via Zoom, Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity College in Hartford. Ibrahim, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lucy.
So often when we think about in this country how our health care is tied to employment, Deborah had called in earlier, wanted to remind people that Access Health CT, that's the public health exchange, has opened up a special enrollment period for people without health care. Prices will be subsidized based on income. If you find that you are without a safety net and you need insurance, please check out accesshealthct.com. The new enrollment period is March 19th through April 2nd. I want to thank my producer, Carmen Baskoff, for producing today's show. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Thanks also to Tess Terrible on the phones. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're going to continue to focus on how coronavirus is impacting all of us in many different ways. If you have particular stories that you want to share, please email me at lucy@ctpublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Thanks for joining us today.